I think this may be as close as to an on-time record as we've ever had at only 7 minutes past the start time. So
that's only because we had so much fun at our last night meeting.
I just assumed that it was because Patsy had baked warm cookies and all of you wanted some before the rest of us ate them.
Ooh, are those raisins? I'm glad I went.
We don't even have
I got one of
these.
Yeah,
that's
right.
Are we on? Of course we are. We're live. He's called us to order.
Yeah, this is all on the microphone. We're going to start with hearings on House Bill 2811 and 3339 from the earlier part of the agenda. And Representative Shetterly, do you have a preference on whether we do 2811 or 3339?
I'd leave that to Kelly Peterson, I think. Probably... 2811?
Want to do 2811 first? Okay, then we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2811. And I'm not sure if people... Did people sign up on the witness sheets for 2811? Okay. Well, why don't we just do this?
Why don't we get another witness list?
Yeah, why don't we get a witness list out there and let people sign up? But I know that Ms. Peterson is going to be leading. You're going to be leading off on the bill? Okay. So why don't everybody who would plan to come up in the first panel come up, and I'll fill in your names on the witness sheet.
Mr. Chair, this could be an historic event, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll see. Mm-hmm. We'll see.
Been trying.
Okay, who wants Ms. Peterson?
Chairman Williams and committee members, my name is Kelly Peterson, and I'm with the Humane Society of the United States, and I'm here to offer testimony in support of House Bill 2811. And the genesis of this bill, along with the other one that was introduced, comes from several roundtable discussions that our organization had with the Oregon Cattlemen's Association and the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association, the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association. I think Oregon Humane Society attended one of those meetings, as well as the owner of the Lebanon Auction Yard. And collectively, we recognized a need to create language that would reduce or minimize the suffering for non-ambulatory animals. And those are animals that can't walk or stand on their own. And we held two brief meetings, and we had numerous follow-up conversations in order to draft a concept that was acceptable or agreeable to all parties. And we're very thankful to Representative Shetterly, who patiently worked with all of us to find common ground and who made some valuable recommendations on the language and who recommended separating the bills into two. And the bills are relatively short and simple and common sense. I'll just start with, I guess, House Bill 2811. That would just define and clarify minimum care standards for anyone possessing a non-ambulatory animal. And it would just state that any person, upon recognition of a non-ambulatory animal, must take immediate and ongoing care to render the animal ambulatory, which is standing, or they must humanely euthanize the animal. And in the minimum care statute, this could be already implied, but it's not specifically outlined. So, therefore, the intent of this bill is just to clarify how a person handles a non-ambulatory animal. And just oftentimes, and, you know, back up, oftentimes a livestock animal that can't walk or stand without assistance is very sick or diseased or injured. And it just makes it very difficult for the animal to receive food or water or necessary care. So this bill would just clarify existing law. And I guess with that, I'll
turn on. For the record, Glenn Stonebrink with the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. And I'm here to tell you, and do you have the Dash 1 amendment?
Oh. I think we do, yes.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, I was referring to the Dash 1 amendment.
On page 2, line 1. where the original bill has the word veterinary. The word veterinary is to be taken out and inserted immediate and ongoing. And from the Cattlemen's Association point of view, and I think pretty much from the at least the auction yard owner that we had in our work group, they say that this is what we do anyway. But it does provide some provision to say that that's what you shall do. And so with that amendment, we certainly have no objections to the bill and think it's fine.
And I don't think anybody else had the amendment, did
Mr.
they?
Mr. Chair, I can. It's easy if you want to look at page 2.
I sent Mr. Taylor out to get it, but go ahead and talk us through
it. If you want to look at page 2, line 1, you simply delete veterinary and insert in place of that immediate and ongoing, recognizing that that provides more flexibility.
And that's the extent of the...
That's the dash ones.
The dash ones just delete the word veterinary and it inserts immediate and ongoing.
That's right.
Okay. Thanks, Glenn. Marcia, are you up next?
I will go next. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Excuse me, members of the committee. My name is Marcia Keith, and I'm with Dave Barrows and Associates here today representing the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association. And I'm here to speak in support of House Bill 2811. OVMA participated in the discussions that resulted in the introduction of this bill, and we're happy to support the bill, particularly with the Dash 1 amendments. We feel it's reasonable to include humane euthanasia and immediate and ongoing care in the definition of minimum care for non-ambulatory livestock animal.
Okay. Thank you, Marcia.
I am Bruce Anderson. I'm with the Eugene Livestock Auction and president of the Oregon Livestock Auction Association. And on my way here, I was opposed, but since it's been rewritten, I will accept the rewrite.
Well, isn't that great? So you were opposed until you saw the amendments?
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
Well, I know we're not in work session yet, but I do want to thank all... Well, I work mostly with Glenn and Kelly on this thing, but I'm happy to have everybody else here in the choir, too, but commend both of them for, you know, it's funny, you get to these things and it looks very simple, but sometimes the process of getting there isn't so simple, and I think there are pitfalls along the way, and I really do want to commend Mr. Stonebrink and Ms. Peterson in particular for shouldering the heavy load and bringing together interests on this thing and making this bill look easy. I think that's a great accomplishment on their parts.
Okay. Any questions for the panel about the bill? Okay. Then I'll close the public. Oh, I'm sorry. We got more people to testify. All right. Good.
Just one.
Okay. Good. So why don't we dismiss the panel? We'll bring up who else we've got here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Lieutenant Randy Covey, Law Enforcement Division, Oregon Humane Society. I'll make this brief. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2811 and the Dash 1 amendments. Speaking from an enforcement standpoint, I certainly have dealt with situations where non-ambulatory livestock have been left, and this amendment or this bill will help in actual real-life situations deal with those. And so on behalf of the Oregon Humane Society and law enforcement, I support this bill with the Dash 1 amendment.
Okay. Any questions for Lieutenant Covey before we let him go? All right. Thank you very much. Close the public. Anybody else here to testify on 2811? Okay. I'm going to close the public hearing. I'm going to open a work session.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Shetterly.
Move the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2811.
Representative Shetterly moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2811. Is there any discussion? Any objection? The amendments are in.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Shetterly.
Move House Bill 2811 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Shetterly
moves. As amended.
House Bill 2811 is amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Okay, Patsy, you want to call the roll?
Representative
Barker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Crummel?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Brzezinski?
Aye.
Representative Brzezinski?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. House Bill 2811, as amended, moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Shetterly, would you like to carry it?
I'd be pleased to carry that.
Okay.
Thank you.
And now we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3339. And is it the same team? Is it the same team? All right, come on up again. Same team, come on up.
Yes.
And I think there are probably amendments to this bill, which Mr. Taylor is going to have to copy right now. Well, you all look very familiar. Why don't we start with Ms. Peterson again?
Okay. Chair Williams, members of the committee, I'm here to also offer support to House Bill 3339. And again, there are amendments that looks like you don't have. But this bill would just further prohibit a person from knowingly delivering or accepting a non-ambulatory livestock animal to a live auction market. The rest of the bill that I think you see there included stockyard and feedlots. That's no longer part of the bill, so it's just live auction markets. And we just feel that it's very difficult, nearly impossible, to humanely move non-ambulatory livestock animals onto trucks and off trucks. So we're just trying to minimize the movement as much as possible. And I wonder if I should just close with that.
You want to go next, Glenn? Are you done, Kelly?
For the record, Glenn Stonebrink with the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. As you can see with the Dash 1 amendments, the only concern we had from our work group was on line 8, and it had the definition of stockyards, and that got into a total different area than the marketing chain channel. So lines 8 through 12 were deleted, and if you have the Dash 1s, you can see that it refers to livestock auction markets as defined in 599-205, and that is the place where we have considered that the so-called downers, non-ambulatory animals, I think that addresses the problem area. And so we've offered those amendments. I just want to bring your attention to lines 13 and 14 of the bill. And this is where the crime. It says a person commits a crime of trading in non-ambulatory livestock if the person knowingly delivers or accepts delivery of non-ambulatory livestock at livestock auction market. And the only concern we had was, besides the definition, was that it was, and I will have to say that working with Kelly Peterson, was kind of been a mutual learning experience for both of us. I think she learned a little bit more about our cattle business, and we learned a little bit more about her business. So, but the term knowingly delivers is key, because when cattlemen oftentimes haul their cattle or calves to an auction yard, there can be one of the critters will fall down or get hit by another animal, and they will go down. They tend to sulk when they go down, so you unload the rest of the animals. Oftentimes, I mean, just virtually all the time, they eventually will get up on their own if it's necessary and given proper unloading techniques. And if you leave them alone in the shade of a tree, give them water, they'll get up on their own. Of course, if they can get up, if they're actually injured, then, you know, we don't want them to be dragged by the neck or anything else into the auction yard either. So just close with, as amended, a good bill should pass.
Okay. Thanks, Klein. Marcia, you want to go next?
Thanks. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Marcia Keith, representing Oregon Veterinary Medical Association, and I'm here to support House Bill 3339. As with House Bill 2811, we participated in the discussions, and we're happy with the resulting bill, and particularly with the amendments.
Okay. Mr. Anderson.
On his way down, he was
way up. With the amendments, we, the Auctioneer Association, will accept the bill.
Okay. All right. And Mr. Covey.
Lieutenant Covey, for the record, representing the Oregon Humane Society. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I too support the House Bill 3339, as mentioned, and I also want to commend folks that have done the work on this and the cooperation that's gone into it. Thank you.
Do you remember that old show, A-Team? And the guy who would, well, no, the guy who would always say, "I love it when a plan comes together." I mean, look at everybody all together. Representative Shetterly.
Well, just again, since we're on a different record, I want to thank and commend the Marcia and Kelly and Glenn in particular. I think some of this drafting was language even that Glenn had suggested, and I appreciate that. It was good input. It did reflect the knowledge of his business that I didn't have, certainly, and so I think he was very, very helpful in that respect, and I appreciate that input. And as to Glenn, as to your concern, I think it's also worth noting for the record that in the bill, I think non-ambulatory is defined as unable to stand or walk without assistance. So if you got just a stubborn or a sulking cow, I think you're pretty well covered there. So, but I think it's good to have on the record because I didn't know those things happened. But again, I just want to thank those folks for working hard to make this thing come together.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just add one other thing.
Please do.
One accolade should also go to Roger Huffman from the Oregon Department of Agriculture. He helped facilitate some of our work group meetings and kept us apprised of what the law is. It's very helpful.
Okay, thank you very much, Glenn. Are there questions for the panel? Representative Brzezinski.
I don't want to break the unity here, but I do have a question. Knowing from my background in Texas, hot shots used to be used in loading and unloading of animals. Is that not allowed today?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know, honestly. I know from my own experience that we didn't do that, and I'll tell you why. And I think it's a thing that, if by law they can't do it, it's a thing of the past. What you can do with those is you bruise the animal.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that we're looking for is every tiny bit of possible profit we can get. And if you have diminished the quality of the meat, then you're going to diminish the price. And so it kind of is self-cleansing, if you will.
Great.
Is his reference, which some of us might not know, is that a taser? Is that a cattle prod, what most of us would refer to as a cattle prod?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, now they use them on wrestlers and at Worldwide Wrestling Federation.
That's entertainment.
Wrestling entertainment.
Great. Any other questions for the panel? All right. Well, what I love about this committee is the diversity of issues we get to discuss. So the chair will close the public hearing on House Bill 3339 and thank the panel for their participation. I'll open a work session.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
I really do hate to start the evening session on such a downer. But I would
that was really bad.
Bad.
Bad? Is that bad?
No more good.
the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3339.
Representative Shetterly moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3339. Is there discussion? Objection. The amendments are adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
Move House Bill 3339 to the floor with a due pass as amended.
Representative Shetterly moves House Bill 3339 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on his motion? Hearing none, Patsy, call the roll.
Representative Barker.
Aye.
Representative Jensen.
Aye.
Representative Fremmel.
Aye.
Representative McPherson.
Aye.
Representative Brzezinski.
Aye.
Representative Shetterly.
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman.
Aye.
Chair Williams.
Aye. House Bill 3339 is amended, moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
How about our Texas boy?
Floyd?
Sure.
Hey, okay, all right, good.
He's our hot shot.
He's our, yeah, he can wear his boots. And like they always said where I grew up, all hat, no cattle.
All right,
so Representative Brzezinski will carry that bill.
I got it.
Right. Now we're going to back up further up on the agenda, and we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2733, and call Representative Przanski to come talk to us about his bill.
You said 2733, Mr. Chair?
2733.
33.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Boy Przanski, State Representative, House District 8. 2733 is one of two bills that you will be hearing. This is the first one. Tomorrow we'll bring the accompanying bill, 2732. What 2733 is going to do is actually clean up a statute that was revised, my understanding, back most recently in 1999 when the, prior to 97, when the legislature condensed traffic infractions into violations. And as they were doing the wording, some of the individuals who worked on the bills thought that possibly some of the language wasn't cleared to the point that it should be for clarity. The reason that I'm bringing 2733 forward is to give some clarity specifically as it pertains to municipal courts. The language that would be updated in this statute will make it very clear that a city has limited jurisdiction for their cases. That jurisdiction is for offenses that occur within the city's city limits or its jurisdiction. And you would not see cases that would start outside of the jurisdiction being cited into that court. As an example, we have a city in on I-5 or just off of I-5, city of Cobourg. They have a municipal court. They have been known to actually utilize the I-5 corridor to write tickets. They are now citing those individuals who are getting excessive speed tickets into their city court. I-5 is not within the city limits of Cobourg. What we are attempting to do is make certain that they understand, as well as anyone else that has a municipal court, that they will only be able to hear cases that are generated within their community, within their jurisdiction, and that they will not be able to, move citations into their municipal court where they would have a funding incentive for doing so. I will be glad to answer any questions that members may have.
Other questions for Representative Przanski on the bill? Representative Ackerman.
It's my experience that the Lane Justice Court has a defined jurisdictional line that does not necessarily encompass the entire county. And so, for example, under your bill, if I was cited in the city of Eugene, could I be cited, or could I would they write the citation to the Lane Justice Court? The only reason why I know that is because I've beaten a lot of cases there, because they have a geographic distribution that doesn't follow any county, any other geographic line.
Yeah, Chair Williams and Representative Ackerman, I'm not sure what the actual geographic line is for this Lane County Central Justice Court. I do know that in this particular case, this is where cases would be cited or should be cited when they fall outside of a municipal jurisdiction, that they would go from, let's say, off of north of I-5 or on I-5 north of Eugene Springfield. That is the proper location for venue or into the Lane Circuit Court. That would be the two courts they would use. Regarding the ability to cite someone from Eugene for a citation that occurred within the city limits of Eugene into the Central Justice Court, I'm not sure if they can. I don't practice as they wouldn't be doing that. They'd be using their own municipal court. But I don't know if they are prohibited by the
I think the main question I'm raising is the justice courts don't, their geographic limits are usually prescribed by an ordinance, and is substantially less than what the county is.
Right.
There's a patchwork.
That's true. I mean, the same thing with Florence Justice Court and Oak Ridge Justice Court. All three of those courts are JP courts within Lane County, and they do have geographic location. And then I know that some officers will ask individuals if they want to be cited into the JP court or if they would prefer going to the Lane County Circuit Court, which is in downtown Eugene.
Representative Shetterly, then Representative Anderson.
Just for clarification, then, I guess, does this bill then really expand the jurisdictional limit of the JP court? We don't have a JP court in Polk County, but as I read it, then it says if a violation proceeding is commenced in the county, let's say, in which the violation was committed, the proceeding may be commenced in a circuit court or justice court of the county. And so it sounds to me like you really can be cited into, let's say, the Lane County Justice Court, even if the offense was not committed within the jurisdictional limit of the Lane County Justice Court. And are you saying you've won a lot of cases because they've been cited?
I don't want to lose that defense.
Yeah, okay.
No, I just wonder what the legal question would be, because you might have whether we have the authority to change the jurisdictional limits of the Justice Court. I don't know.
The intent of this bill is not to change what is geographically marked already, but is to make clear that the options are limited based on what was previously in the statute, and making certain that municipal courts understand that their jurisdiction is very limited. It's limited to their city limits, and that they do not have jurisdiction or venue for cases that are being committed, where the offense is committed outside of the city limits.
I'll just see if I can summarize. Oh, Representative Anderson? Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry. Can you pull your mic over there so you're on the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you give me a little more illustration regarding the Coburg
you're
trying to keep them, or you're kind of trying to say you don't have jurisdiction out on the freeway. Yours are only within the city limit in Coburg or Harrisburg, or I assume that, is this Chad Limhouse's?
It is not. Jad's is actually above that. Jad and I have spoken about this, and based on my discussion, well, he had no problem with 2733. 2732, which you'll hear tomorrow, he is receptive to what we're attempting to address for the reasons. What this bill does...
The little towns around that he does have jurisdiction in, but if it's just outside of that, he wouldn't go. Where would it go? Would it go to the county court?
It would go to, if they have a justice of the peace court, it could potentially go there if it's within their geographic boundary of that court, or it could go to the circuit court for the county. That is how most people read the statute as it has been written. But the concern was when we made the changes in including violation or traffic infractions, and in renaming them as violations, there was some tinkering with the statute, and there's been at least a difference of opinion as to how they are reading the court as this statute as to what is the closest court for citation. This does not in any way prohibit or limit a city in having a municipal court and hearing violations that occur within its jurisdiction.
But essentially what you're trying to do, Floyd, is you're trying to stop a city from setting up outside its jurisdiction, I don't want to say the word speed trap, but patrolling a particular area where they're citing people not within their jurisdiction into their city court as essentially a revenue mechanism.
That's correct. But this, when you see the next bill that will be tomorrow, the officers in this state who are sworn police officers in Oregon will still be able to enforce the law anywhere and everywhere within the state. The issue really comes as to what happens when they are cited to whatever particular court. What has happened, the history on this case scenarios, this has been going on for years. And there's actually a story, and you'll see I'll bring paperwork in for the next bill, 2732, as to exactly what has transpired. They were originally citing these cases into the Lane Circuit, the Lane Central Justice Court. And they now have come up with a interpretation of the current statute, which 2733 hopes to address, and say they believe that they now can actually take these cases, instead of putting them into the justice court or the circuit court, bring them into their municipal court. And what we're doing here, the language is very explicit between lines 10 through 12 to say that the only time that a municipal court has jurisdiction is when an offense actually is committed within its within the city limits.
So without this, then you do leave open the potential that, and let's just use my area, if the City of Tigard cops figured out that there was a better intersection in Beaverton that if they covered, they could go cover that intersection, cite them into the City of Tigard Municipal Court. This statute would avoid sort of that poaching.
That's correct.
Okay.
And it would also, I mean, the reason that you, the, in my opinion, the reason the shift has gone to the municipal court, because when it goes through your own court, the formula for distributions of fines is greater to your city than it is to, than if you go through the JP court or through the circuit court.
Council, I had a question, and then Representative Crummell, and then Representative McPherson.
Why don't you go to the representative?
Okay, all right, Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Council, and thank you, Mr. Chair. So, and as, besides cutting off another profit center for the cities, which are, if a city has an interstate freeway, which actually, even though it's in their city boundaries, I don't believe it's considered to be necessarily within their jurisdiction. But if they have a, an agreement with the state police as far as patrol and that sort of thing in the stretch that is within the city for patrol and enforcement, would those cases be referred into the city court, or would they have to then go to the circuit court or JP court?
No. Mr. Chair and Representative Crummell, it's my opinion that they would actually have jurisdiction. If the interstate passes through their city, that is, in fact, as far as I'm concerned, in the way I would interpret it, within their city limits, and they could, in fact, and would, in fact, have jurisdiction, and the correct venue would be municipal court or a circuit court, or possibly if there's a JP court that would have that geographic area. So it would not. This is not going to stop anyone from doing anything that is within their jurisdiction. This is basically trying to make certain that everyone's reading the statute the way it was intended to be read, is that municipal courts are limited in their jurisdiction to what's within their city limits.
Okay.
You might check with Representative Barker, but I think when you have that freeway going through the middle of your city, they refer to that as pay dirt. Isn't that right, Representative Barker?
Tried to stay off of that thing. Cars go way too fast.
Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm having difficulty parsing the language, but I want to see if I understand it correctly, that if the exception that applies when the county seat of the outside county is closer to than the county seat in which the infraction occurs, that it could then be held in a municipal court, even though outside the city boundaries, so that...
No.
Okay, I'm not.
It can be heard in the other counties, in the adjacent county, as compared to the county seat. I'll give some example using Lane County again. If you had a violation that occurred right off over the Linn County line in Lane County, I'm surmising that the distance between Albany and the Linn County line is probably closer than it is to Eugene. And in that case, the officer could cite into the adjacent county because it's closer in distance to where the infraction occurs. There's not any time when a violation that occurs outside of a municipal jurisdiction should it be allowed to be cited into the municipal court for adjudication.
Council, maybe you can help
us. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm like Representative McPherson, and this is a very, very difficult bill to read. I mean, yeah. I've talked to Representative Brzezanski, I've talked to Legislative Counsel's office, but I have to read the way I read the bill on lines 13 through line 17. For example, and we talked about this, Representative Brzezanski, let's say I was stopped for speeding just across the bridge in Polk County in West Salem, and I was stopped by a Salem police officer. The way I read the bill on Section B, I could be cited into the Municipal Court of Salem, Judge Gruber's court. And the reason I say that is because of the violation, and I'm reading the language, if a violation proceeding is commenced in a county other than the county in which the violation has committed, so that would be in Polk County, but proceedings may be commenced in the circuit court, and you go back above, the closest place to where the closest court would be in downtown Salem, it's only a mile or two away, or notwithstanding the provisions of ORS 51050 and 221339 that limits the jurisdiction of justice courts to offenses committed within the county and municipal courts, city courts, to offenses committed within the jurisdictional authority of the city in a justice or municipal court. So the way I read that, and I believe that's current law too, is that
it is.
I could be cited into the Salem courts, Salem City
Thank
Court.
Thank you, counsel. That's what I was trying to articulate and doing a poor job of. But it looked to me as though if it were you were outside the county, then you could. Where the action is commenced, you could be cited into a municipal court, even though if you're inside the county, you couldn't.
Mm-hmm. Bringing in
municipal Judge Myers,
a pinch hitter.
It's good to have you here,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Carl Myers, on behalf of the Oregon Municipal Judges Association. I understood, I think, Representative McPherson's questions. I'm not sure I understood counsel's question. Could you repeat that, Mr.
That's
Chair?
Interesting, because they both understood each other and thought
they
were
on the same path. Let me say that in answer to Representative McPherson's question, if you are stopped inside the city limits of the city of Salem in Polk County, instead of having concurrent jurisdiction between the municipal court and the Polk County Circuit Court, the police officer can cite either to the Salem Municipal Court, which has jurisdiction within the city limits of the city of Salem, or they could cite to the Circuit Court of Marion County because it is the closest county seat to where the occurrence, mm-hmm. even though it occurred in Polk County, they can cite for convenience to Circuit Court in Marion County, and the Salem Police Department often do that, so that their appearance would then be in downtown Salem as opposed to in Dallas. This bill doesn't change that overlapping jurisdiction. Am I responsive to your question?
I want to get back to Representative Brzezinski, though. Is that what you intended the bill to do? I mean, if we continue to have the overlapping jurisdiction as it was described, it still, I think, doesn't allow. I guess I'm still struggling to figure out. Is that different than saying that a municipal officer has to cite within his? He can write the ticket anywhere he wants, but he's got to send the ticket back to the jurisdiction that he's currently in at the time. He can't be outside the city limits of Salem and keep trying to send it back to the Salem Municipal Court.
That's correct.
But he could cite it back to the Circuit Court in Salem.
Correct.
He was across the bridge in Polk County.
And the Marion County Circuit Court seat in Salem was the closest Circuit Court seat to that
right.
offense.
I feel like I need a chart or a map.
Mr. Chairman, two things. The way I read it is, even if he weren't within the city of Salem, he could be just outside the city of Salem. Nonetheless, if downtown, the county seat in Marion County were closer than the one in Polk County, they could still cite into the Salem Municipal Court. Having said that, I have to admit, it's a short bill. This may be the toughest bill I've had to read all session to try to figure out. I had to diagram it.
My point
it's not the
is,
bill,
it
it's
looks
the
to me as though there. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. It appears to me as though there is a circumstance where an offense committed outside of a municipal outside the city boundaries could still wind up in municipal court, but it is ironically enough when that municipal court is in the other county.
Representative Barker,
I would suggest an amendment that just says that municipal courts can only hear cases for violations within the city limits, within the municipal boundaries. And then that gets to what you're trying to do. You want municipal courts only to have violations from inside that city limits. You don't want them going out and bringing them in.
Well, I don't have any problem if a city of Salem police officer is outside the city limits
right.
and he sees a violation
right.
and he pulls the person over and he writes it a ticket.
He can't send it to Salem.
And the county court is
right.
closer in Marion County than sending him out to Polk County, even though he's in Polk County, that he cites him into the Marion County Circuit Court. That seems reasonable. But if you let him cite him into the City of Salem Municipal Court, then you're back to the situation where people can poach, and I think
that's
you want to avoid the poaching.
That's my thing.
I'm just wondering if you know if you'd want to look at amending chapter 221. That's the municipal court chapter, and make an amendment specifically in within the deals within the municipal court statutes, delimiting their jurisdiction to offenses that occur within the city limits of the city. Is that easier than getting all enmeshed with circuit court and justice court jurisdiction if what we're after is Coburg citing people out on I-5?
Mr. Chair, Representative Shetterly, I still think you need to have the language in 153 consistent with that change. And it's the 153 language that I think has been misinterpreted by some courts to allow them. I will say for the record, Mr. Chair, that all the municipal judges I've talked with have read the statute as I think it should be read, and that is that venue for handling a case in a municipal court can only be if that the offense occurred or the violation occurred within the boundaries of that jurisdiction. And I've had several cases in my court where I've had to throw them out because it occurred right outside of the city limits of the city of Kaiser where I sit. That action should have then been brought in Marion County Justice Court or in the Circuit Court. I think it's a venue question, and if fixing 221 would add clarity to that, the municipal judges have no objection, but I do think that 153 needs to be clarified as well.
Council?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think if we went down to line 17, and this is what Legislative Council's office would do, and took out our municipal,
right,
and then took out the provisions up above that relate to 221.339 and the other reference in line 16 to municipal courts, I think that would get us there.
Mr. Chair, and
yeah.
I was going to say, and listening to what Council said, I was actually taking or municipal out on line 17 and then seeing what else we may need to revise in that sub B from 13 through 17 to give clarity. Because I believe that the intent is captured on lines 10 through 12, and then we just need to make certain that we don't throw ourselves back into a misinterpretation.
Yeah, and it is complicated enough reading that some way to clean it up in a better way makes sense. I think everybody sort of understands where we
right.
want to go. It is always complicated. I think people don't always understand that, you know, in any given violation, there are three different places that the officer could potentially cite you into, depending on where you're at. But that's helpful. Any other questions for the panel? A little bit of traffic school today. I was going to ask Representative Ackerman, when he was so regularly in that justice court in Lane County, was he defending himself or was it clients that he was there on behalf of? But I won't make him say that on the record.
No, don't have to.
Okay, is there anyone else here to testify on House Bill 2733? Okay, seeing none, then we'll close the public hearing. And you'll work on amendments then.
Immediately.
What? I closed the public hearing.
Okay. 29.339 sub 1.
Or not in public hearing now, so this isn't going to be on the record.
That says within the city limits.
Well, see, that's the issue. Is it comes back to the venue.
No, I'm sorry.
229.
You guys just keep talking about it, would you? And when you get it figured out, come tell the rest of us. Okay, we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2736. And
Mr. Chair and committee members, Floyd Przanski, State Representative, House District 8. Hopefully, this will be a little more smooth and direct. This is Bill. Asked to commit create a new crime of interfering with a firefighter or emergency medical technician. This is based similar law that we have is interfering with a peace officer when they're carrying out their duty. The reason this bill is coming forward is because I've had two different situations, one in my capacity as a prosecutor, the other as a police commissioner for the city of Eugene, that has raised concerns as to what we're seeing happening to these first line, first responders in situations. In the city of Florence, we had a situation where an EMT was attempting to provide medical service to an individual. At the time that he was in the process of doing that, an acquaintance of the individual that was being helped by the EMT interfered with his ability to provide them with the medical assistance they needed, and they actually had to stop in the course of treatment and deal with this other individual who was interfering with that procedure. The other is one that's probably even more scary in the sense of for firefighters. Firefighters have always been, that I want to say, kind of considered a neutrality or a neutral party when there are situations that occur in urban violence or situations. We've recently, as we normally do on an annual basis in the city of Eugene, have University of Oregon students who, and non-students, I should say, who live in the immediate vicinity of the university, sometimes having a little bit more alcohol than they probably should consume, and then acting out of, let's say, lack of age and character. What has happened the last time is we had fires that were started in the middle of the street. We had officers that were there, as well as firefighters that had to be called in to extinguish the blazes. As the firefighters were attempting to deal with the situation, and this was in an area on the West University area, which specifically would have been the corners of 14th and Ferry, we had police officers who had to basically make a decision as to whether they were going to use crowd control techniques to move people back or turn around and go back and protect firefighters who were having bottles and other objects thrown at them while they were trying to put out fires in the middle of the street. This is a public safety concern for myself and for others, and that's why we brought the bill before you today.
Okay. Questions, Representative Jensen?
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair. I assume there are some other crimes that could be prosecuted for if in the process of interfering with a firefighter or an EMT, there's either some kind of significant economic loss or physical harm to an individual that goes unattended or results in some personal injury loss?
Mr. Chair and Representative Jensen, regarding potential other crimes that could be used, it really depends on what actually happens at the scene as to the individual firefighter or, in this case, EMT personnel. If the person is actually physically touched, it could be offensive physical contact, which would be a Class B misdemeanor, would be harassment. If there's actual physical assault, which results in injury to the individual, then the person could be charged with the assault. That's a Class A misdemeanor. The last would be potentially disorderly conduct, where technically if someone is blocking the roadway and in the sense of standing in the middle of a street, they could be cited for a Class C misdemeanor of disorderly conduct. The concern here is that in many of these situations, we do not have an individual actually making physical contact or causing injury to fire personnel or to the EMTs. What we have is a requirement of these individuals who are attempting to do their job being diverted from doing their job and basically either taking cover or taking some type of corrective action to protect themselves from potentially getting hit, hurt, or just not being able to carry out their job. Regarding monetary damages and stuff like that, I guess there would be potential for civil suits if there were some type of physical contact, injury resulting, but I am not sure if that's the area that you're concerned with.
Representative Jensen?
Clarification. Let's take the ultimate and perhaps illogical extreme. But in this interfering with an EMT, the EMT fails to be able to get to someone who is physically injured, and as a consequence, the person dies. Now, $5,000 or a year in jail seems somewhat inadequate to deal with that. My question is, I assume there are other crimes with which we can prosecute.
There are crimes with a mens rea of where they could be charged with maybe negligent homicide, criminal, on reckless, based on their conduct, posing such a threat.
Okay, Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Brzezinski, so would this allow the firefighter or paramedic trying to work on somebody drunks or bothering them, coming in and grabbing at them or whatever, they could do like the policeman did and say, get back, you have to be back 10 feet or you'll be arrested for interfering. So that would give them that kind of, that, this is what you're after, the same thing as the police interference with the police officer.
That's correct. The intent here is to basically give them the protection that they may need, and I would assume before they were actually going to be citing an individual, they would actually would give that notice, and the statute really and does in fact require intentional acts, and so it, to me it would be based on the person having knowledge that they are interfering with the ability for the personnel to do their job, and if they continue the conduct, then they would be subject to this or any other criminal charges.
Follow up.
Yes.
And you, of course, for a police, that's part of the, you know, part of the normal course of duties is arresting somebody. But so for a paramedic, especially a private company like we have in Portland, what are we going to do about that? Would they just have to ask the police to do that if they could find one? Or
that's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. Yeah, this would not give them any power. I mean, of course, they would have the power that they have as a citizen's arrest, just like a security guard would have as to a shoplifter. But in most cases, what I would expect that would happen would be this would be documented by law enforcement through an investigation or a report taking, and action would come from that.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Oftentimes at an emergency scene, there are volunteer people to help with traffic control or reservists that are called in. Would they be covered as well, or would there be any protection for them?
No, I would say there would not be, based on what you have here, unless the person, well, it says, I mean, we are using the definitions that are for a firefighter or for emergency medical technician, and that are provided, I believe, elsewhere in the statutes. Clearly, if an individual was deputized or given some type of authority, which you are not going to see except in extreme situations, those individuals would not be able to have any greater rights than what they would have as an individual citizen. So you or I who were involved with that and someone came up and assaulted us, we could have a civil cause of action, and we could also report that to a law enforcement agency for them to investigate and file reports with the city or county or state prosecutor.
Follow up.
Yes, follow up.
But if they are deputized, you know, for instance, at a major demonstration, it's angry, they've been deputized around, should they be included in this? Should they be named?
Well, I would tell you that this particular bill, 2736, is limited to interfering with a firefighter or emergency medical technician. I would say that unless they fit that definition of those two individuals or personnel, they would not be covered by this.
They would, however, Floyd, under the definition of firefighter, it would include a volunteer firefighter who is performing his function.
Absolutely.
As a volunteer.
Absolutely.
Firefighter,
that's
or
correct.
A volunteer ambulance person in a volunteer ambulance
right.
organization.
That's correct, as compared to someone coming off the street.
They're already covered as a policeman, as a volunteer police.
Well, there are reserve officers that, I mean, where they are, if they're acting in the scope of their employment, they would be covered under the other one, which is interfering with a peace officer
yeah.
and performing their lawful duties.
Okay, further questions? All right, thank you, Representative Brzezinski. Genoa, are you here to testify on this bill? Just to listen? Okay. Is there anybody else here to testify on House Bill 2736? Floyd, I know you're back now here instead of at the desk, but have you thought about, I mean, I don't imagine this is going to be used all that often. The question is of the fiscal, obviously. As we all know in this committee, and I keep repeating it over and over again, and I know you're tired of hearing it, but, you know, the creation of new crime always raises the issue of how much more, and so have you given that some thought?
I have, and I guess, Mr. Chair, based on my review, I don't believe that this is going to be used that often. I do not have numbers, have not talked to Bill Lemon to see if he has any. I do assume, would expect that these at this point are going to be Class A misdemeanors, and so they're not going to really impact the state per se because it's not at the felony level. It would be more of a local issue. And the type of sanctions that you would expect, well, what's limited is that it would be really more at the local level. And so I don't think it's going to have an impact that's going to affect the concerns that we would have in setting policies for the state. There would be some financial impact, and clearly the jurisdictions would have the ability to enforce or not enforce these.
And someday when our budget recovers, we can actually do something about it. Right, and the people who commit them, other than just booking them and letting them go again.
Right.
All right, are there any other questions? Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2736.
Mr. Chair, I'd move House Bill 2736 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Brzezinski moves House Bill 2736 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Patsy, you want to call the roll?
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Crummell?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Brzezinski?
Aye.
Representative Cheverly?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. House Bill 2736 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Brzezinski to carry. This takes us now, I think, colleagues, into our work sessions. Going to open a work session on House Bill 2034. You'll recall this bill. My recollection is I have memos from most of you saying that you didn't like it. So I think there are amendments, the Dash 6 amendments, which take out, I believe, the offending language.
Page 4, Mr. Chair.
And that gets you to page 4 of the bill. Council, you want to walk us through?
Sure, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The amendments that you have, the Dash 6 amendments, are except for one amendment, which is the one that takes out the issue about sale to minors, are pretty much what we had seen before. For example, on page 1, it changes concentration greater than the current law is 1.5. The bill would have changed it to 3.7. The amendments, which I believe consensus amendments, change it to 2%. Over on page 3, after line 6, insert any practitioner as defined in 475.005 who dispenses a precursor substance to a person with whom the practitioner has a doctor-patient, a doctor-client relationship, and that's to one of the provisions where this law does not apply. So it's going back to page 2, the section does not apply to any of the following: pharmacists, et cetera, licensed state, and then it would also include doctors. Then going over to page, on the same page, line 10, after methane, insert or precursor substance. And then page 4, lines 5 through 19, delete lines 5 through 19. So the bill as originally proposed would have prevented the sale of comb remedies with those substances to minors. And that provision is coming out. And there was a concern that we had in the discussion in the last hearing on the amendments that we applied to sale to the public. And that's no longer in the amendments nor in the bill. It was never put in the bill. That was where you had the big discussion. So, the best of my knowledge, everyone is all the I talked to Ron Bavay, he was here earlier. He thinks the bill is still needed as amended and is supportive of it.
Well, my recollection is there were two issues that we wanted to still address in the bill, to address people's concerns. The thing that people didn't like is they didn't like the minor issue, which mm-hmm. was withdrawn, and they didn't like the putting the stuff behind the counter issue, which I think this amendment resolves.
Mr. Chairman, as a committee,
that was an amendment, wasn't it?
It was in an earlier amendment as proposed by the proponents. That amendment has been withdrawn from consideration. They no longer want to go forward with it. So that issue of sale to the public was never specifically in the bill except as it relates to minors.
The putting it behind the counter?
That was an amendment that we were
That's
considering.
Right.
Okay.
That's right.
All right. Oh, it was? So that wasn't in the bill?
Nope. That's right.
All right. Well, thanks for catching me up. But the two issues that I think were of concern was this change on the percent by weight in a matrix or solution under line 7 on the iodine matrix. And then there was an issue relating to veterinarians that the bill was attempting to address. And I want to make sure that everybody is... And that's in that doctor-patient or doctor-client relationship, I think Marcia had testified before, was the language that was going to address the issue for the veterinarians.
That's why she's here.
You were wondering why she was hanging around, weren't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's it. Marcia, do you want to come up for a second just to give us a little comfort? Have you looked at the Dash 6 amendments? Okay. You want to identify yourself for the record, and then we'll pepper you with questions that you might not know anything about.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Marcia Keith with Dave Barrows and Associates representing the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association. And I have a copy of the Dash 6 amendments, which lay out in lines 3 through 8 of the amendment the language that that our association needs in order to feel comfortable with the bill.
Okay, great. Are there questions for Marcia? Anybody? All right. Representative Anderson?
I'm not really sure I'm relating to this bill correctly. Is this the one that we're going to take the ephedrine and put it, or the triple strength behind bars?
Mm-hmm. Right.
The retailers are saying we don't want to be policemen, essentially.
Right, and so that's not part of the that's not part of the bill, and won't be part of the bill if we if we adopt the Dash 6 amendments. So that and the minor portion, the minors portion, which was on lines, it's on page 4.
Yeah, 5, 7.
5 through 7 were the line, were the was the language involving the minors, and we had, do we have an amendment that withdraws that?
Mm-hmm. No, that's lines 10 and 11 of the Dash 6 amendments.
Correct.
Okay, there it is. 5 through 19 come out. Okay.
No, they don't come out. The bracketed material in those lines is restored, and the bolt face material comes out.
Mm-hmm. All right. Sort of a funny way to write it. Okay. All right. So with those changes, I don't think that they're that alleviated, I think, people's generally strongly held objections to the bill. So what it really is sort of a cleanup to the meth bill that we passed last session, addressing both this percentage by weight issue and the veterinarian issues and some of the language issues in the bill. But the expansion portion is being removed from the bill by the adoption of the Dash 6 amendments. And if it weren't, you'd see this room full of all sorts of angry retailers. Mm-hmm. So I think that in and of itself is some evidence, I think, that they're no longer concerned about the bill. Any further questions? Representative Jensen?
Yes, I'm reading correctly then that Section 3, Sub 3, is deleted.
Yes.
Is that correct? And then all bracketed material through line 19, which it gets us down then to the old sub 5A. Mm-hmm.
Right. Is restored.
Yeah, the bracket material.
Right, the bracketed material is restored.
And all right.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, are you ready for a motion?
I sure am, Representative McPherson.
I will move the Dash 6 amendments into House Bill 2034.
Representative McPherson moves the Dash 6 amendments to House Bill 2034. Is there further discussion on the amendments? Is there any objection? The Dash 6s are adopted. Mr. Chair. Representative McPherson.
I move House Bill 2034 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative McPherson moves House Bill 2034 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on this motion? Seeing none, call the roll. Patsy.
Representative Barker.
Aye.
Representative Jensen.
Aye.
Representative Crummell.
Aye.
Representative McPherson.
Aye.
Representative Krasinski.
Aye.
Representative Cheverly.
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman.
Aye.
Chair Williams.
Aye. House Bill 2034 is amended, moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative McPherson, would you carry it?
Happy to.
Okay.
Chair?
Yes, Council.
The committee on the other three bills that we have in work session, 2082, we're still checking to see if we have the right amendments, if all the parties are in agreement on it. 2174, this is the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission sentencing guidelines bill, and as a result of a court case, and to be on the safe side, what they're doing is they are going to incorporate all their regulations and statute, and the amendments are not done yet. I mean, these are massive amendments. And 7556, this is a bill that we heard just recently, and this is the sex offender juvenile adjudication issue of allowing a juvenile sex offender to have their record expunged, and the proponents have been wrestling for the last week of whether to have the bill amended so it would reduce the fiscal impact, and they are going to ask for an amendment. The amendments are not ready.
Okay. I know there's someone here who wanted to address 2082. So I am going to take us into work session on House Bill 2082 and open that work session. Sir, do you want to come forward? And I'd also point out, colleagues, that there is a dash one amendment to 2082, which is in front of you, and a letter from NAMI, Oregon, NAMI, 2082, that I'm not sure, because I haven't compared them, I'm not sure it necessarily tracks with what that dash one amendment is. So that's by way of information. But if you want to proceed, sir, and give us your thoughts on 2082 and identify yourself for the record.
Yes, thank you. For the record, my name is Jim McLeod. I'm the Manager for Quality Assurance and Certification with the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services, and I'm here to express concerns about House Bill 2082 as introduced on behalf of the Department. There are three reasons for our concerns about this bill. The first has to do with the use of prior arrest information as opposed to conviction information. When determining whether a person should be civilly committed, we consider the arrest information to be unreliable. It's not been adjudicated. Pre-commitment investigators who would be using the information have a period of up to 5 days in which to conduct an investigation before making a recommendation to a court as to whether a civil commitment hearing should be held or not. The use of prior conviction information, as authorized in this bill, could actually help civil commitment investigators make informed decision, and we're not opposed to that part of it. So the aspect relating to convictions would be fine for us. The part relating to the use of arrest information is an area of concern to us because of the unreliability of arrest information. The second concern that we have is that if pre-commitment investigators were allowed access to both arrest and conviction information when determining whether there's probable cause to place a person in a director-initiated custody, an involuntary hold in a hospital setting, as in the first concern, the use of arrest information could again have an undue influence on a person being held involuntarily in a hospital. The third and final concern that we have has to do with the cost of establishing LEDS access in communities throughout the state. The law enforcement data system is accessed through a computerized system, and in order to have timely access to LEDS information, community mental health program directors or their designees would have to access the LEDS systems at sites where involuntary commitment or pre-commitment holds are made, such as emergency rooms in hospitals that are certified by the state. There are 32 community mental health programs in the state for the 36 counties, and the cost of the computer stations, including software and security for them, could be up to $5,000 per unit by our estimations, which would yield an initial startup cost ranging from $5,000 to up to $160,000 to implement the use of the LEDS system, depending on the number of facilities with which the LEDS access software and hardware would be installed. And that would have to be absorbed by the community mental health programs. In addition, there's a monthly LEDS fee associated with access to the LEDS system, which is approximately $50 per month. These costs for the 2003 to 2005 biennium are not included in the governor's budget, and so they would need to be absorbed into the existing community mental health program budgets. So given these concerns, the department is not in favor of House Bill 2082 as introduced.
Have you seen the Dash 1 amendment?
Yeah, I was going to say, I would add that I picked them up over here and looked at them, and I think that the Dash 1 amendments really do address the concerns we have. They would pull out the use of arrest information but would keep conviction information. The other component of it that includes language about subject to availability of funds would address the cost issues that we would be concerned about as well. So I think the difference that I see in looking at the Dash 1 amendments would place this bill into a realm that we would not be in opposition to.
Okay. Yeah, as I read the Dash 1 amendments, it limits the necessity of providing the LEDS access only when the resources were available, and it only limits the involvement either in the investigative report process or in the probable cause analysis to only records of convictions that are contained therein. So it seemed to address much of the concerns that I don't think it addressed all the concerns, but I think it addressed much of the concerns that we heard when the bill had a first hearing. But again, I'm not sure that this is the only amendment that's coming, and before we decide to take action on the bill, we want to make sure that we've gotten any other amendments or responses from the participants. Is there any questions, Representative Jensen?
Mr. Chair, not questions from the department, I don't think as such, but just some questions and observations for the committee. As I've indicated to the chair, I'm very strongly opposed to this particular bill, and my opposition to it comes from something in the neighborhood of 20 years of history of living with someone who was very actively involved in this process of commitment of the mentally ill to a state facility or to other perhaps even private facilities. And I would have been happy to have got her to have come down to testify before this committee in opposition to it, to this bill, but she refuses to work at night. So
well, tell her we'll take her written testimony if she wants to submit it, Representative.
But I do feel very strongly about it, and I think there's an issue of protection of the mentally ill in this, and I think there's some significant possibility of the use of LEDs as a crutch for civilly committing people, and I believe the system as it exists at the present time works reasonably well. It's taken a long time, if I understand it, correctly, to basically educate the judicial system as to how that whole process works, and that's no reflection on the judicial system. It was just something that came along different from what they're generally accustomed to doing, and I'd be most reluctant to try to or at this stage interfere with that process, especially at a time when there are some uncertainties about this, and where there are some uncertainties, I think, as to perhaps what the costs of this might be to us as far as the state is concerned. So it's one of those bills, I think, that we would, if there's a feeling on people's part that they do want to move forward with this, I think it's one that deserves to be considered over a longer period of time maybe than we have in the committee here, and it might be well to keep it on the burner for subsequent sessions of the legislature. So much for that.
I do appreciate that comment, Representative Jensen. So, this this bill and this issue was on the burner in the previous legislative session and met with about the same level of approach anyway. I don't know if I'd say enthusiasm, but of approach.
That's a simmer, not a boil.
Yeah, it has been on a simmer. So, but I appreciate your comments, and certainly, and I meant that in all seriousness. If your wife would like to submit testimony, we'd be happy to receive it into the record.
Thank you.
Anything else? Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing, the work session on 2082. And we're not going to move on the others because we don't have amendments. And with that committee, we're adjourned for the evening. Fair. Thanks very much for your hard work. Yes.
Great big amendment that we can put on the last bill you have from a bill that I had here two sessions ago. That I can just bet and stuff it for you if you want.